Another one that I recall was Faye Weldon's reading, after which she actually invited all members of the audience to send her copies of their novels in progress, which is a crazy thing to do. Now, I don't think that Doris Lessing will be putting out any feelers for manuscripts this evening, but I'm sure that the evening will be as memorable as those evenings. And as such, I want to give it a more personal introduction than I usually do. Doris Lessing was born in Persia on the 22nd of October, 1919. I mentioned that because I'd like us all to wish her a belated happy birthday. I think Lessing's life has been a challenge to a belief that people cannot resist the currents of their time, as she fought against the biological and cultural imperatives that fated her to sink without a murmur into marriage and motherhood. Lessing believes that she was made freer because freer than most people, because she was a writer. Now, for her, writing is a process of, as she puts it, setting at a distance, taking the raw, the individual, the uncriticised, the unexamined, into the realm of the general. As such, her fiction is deeply autobiographical. Much of it emerges from her experiences of Africa. Drawing upon her childhood memories and her serious engagement with politics and social concerns, she's written about the clash of cultures, the gross injustices of racial inequality, the struggle among opposing elements within an individual's own personality, and the conflict between the individual conscience and the collective good. These are big issues. Her stories and novellas set in Africa, published during the 50s and early 60s, decry the dispossession of black Africans by white colonials, and they expose the sterility of the white culture in southern Africa of that time. Now, in this way, to my mind, Doris has steered important debates in our societies and in our politics, and she's done it through her life and through her art, and I think she deserves our thanks for that. Now, her novels include, among many others, The Grass is Singing, The Good Terrorist, The Fifth Child, and this year, Ben in the World. Now, she's also written several non-fiction works, including a book about cats, which has been a love since childhood, as well as two volumes of autobiography. And I've discovered one thing that unites Benita here and Doris, which is a deep and abiding love affair with cats, and quite right too. Let me introduce you then to Professor Benita Perry, a very good friend of mine and collegial colleague. She's the author of Delusions and Discoveries, Studies on India in the British Imagination, and Conrad and Imperialism, Ideological Boundaries and Visionary Frontiers. Benita and myself will be chairing the session and leading the discussion with the discussion that takes place after Doris has done her reading, which will include yourselves, the audience, as well. Now, we hope to finish the event by about 8:30, and there will be a chance for you also to go back outside this room and purchase books, and I know that Doris is going to be happy to sign them. Now, there's one last advert before I hand over to Benita, and you'll be cursing me, those people who have already just bought books. As you know from your Writers at Warwick and Art Centre brochure, you can redeem your ticket for this event against 20% of the cost of the books. In other words, depending on how many books you buy, or if you go for just one big hardback, you can go to this event free of charge, okay? And you can get the cost back in your own pocket. Now, I just want to mention, finally, Doris Lessing's 1996 novel, Love Again. I mention it because she didn't make any personal appearances to promote the book, despite pressures from her publishers, HarperCollins. And in an interview at that time, she described the frustration she felt during a 14-week worldwide tour to promote her autobiography. And this is a quote. "I told my publishers it would be far more useful for everyone if I stayed at home, writing another book. But they wouldn't listen. This time round, I stamped my little foot and said I would not move from my house and would do only one interview. So, you can imagine how glad I am to have you here, Doris. Thank you for your patience. I'm very honoured to introduce Doris Lessing and Benita Perry.
Wrong. I'm going to read from two books. One came out last year. It was Mara and Dan. It is an adventure story. It's an absolutely classical adventure story. An adventure story needs to have a heavily disadvantaged protagonist. In this case, orphans. These orphans have to have a cruel stepmother or father, or be in prison, or be in some way horribly ill-treated. And from sheer force of character, they have to get themselves out of their situation, and after many, many hazards, there's a happy ending. So this is what I did with this story, because I've always wanted to write an adventure story. Now, I wanted to set it in a not our culture. Our culture, oh, it has to be have telephones, take away food, I don't know, fast cars. To actually write an adventure story, it's going to turn out like James Bond. It's almost impossible not to write an adventure story without all the techniques. So I've made a so-called primitive culture, set it in the future, but I don't care, it could be in the past for all I care. And it's in a continent called Ifrit. Now, this continent is in the grip of one of these great climatic changes which is in all our minds at the moment. In this case, it has been drying out for a long time. This story goes from extreme drought and dust to the north, where it is very wet, because the ice age, that's the one that's going to come next, quite soon or tomorrow, or 1,000 years, and that will be the end of Europe, because we're going to be under many hundreds of feet of ice. And that too will change, and at the end of this book, this ice age is going. The water is pouring in again through what have been called the gates of Pillars of Hercules, from what we call the Atlantic, to fill the Mediterranean, which is dry, the Middle Sea. There was between one of the ice ages, the Mediterranean was completely dry. We always talk about the last ice age as if there's only been one, but there have been very, very many of many kinds. And one of them was so bad that it came halfway down Africa and almost down to the sea. That was one of the great ice ages of the past. Anyway, so here we are going from dust, which I certainly didn't invent, because I was observing the drought in Zimbabwe that ended in 1992, where women were getting up at 4 a.m. to walk 10 miles to get a can of water, which would do for their families to drink and to cook with for that day. No washing or washing of clothes. Animals dying, birds dying. I saw all that, so I wrote about it. It rather looks, from what's happening now, as I could easily have written the end of this book with what's happening now, with water everywhere. So this book begins in drought and ends in water. This is the beginning of the watery bit. What has happened is that the Ifrit, which has been all permafrost and covered with cities that have been copied from our cities, because we were a great golden age. Which live on in the memory of these of our future descendants, as these amazing people who did all these things. Our cities were copied and built on the permafrost, which of course is now melting. So on this last night before the river, Dowlis said they should make the most of the comforts of the inn, because once they were on the boats, the river and lakeside inns would be a very different thing. And so they took care to wash well in the plentiful hot water and eat well and to sleep well. In the morning they walked along the road they had been following for days, and then they were standing on the edge of water where little waves ran up to the sandy verges. And what did you see, Mara? What did you see? Now, the Mahundis teach their children at the end of every day they call the children and say to them, "What have you seen today?" This game, which begins simply like, "Oh, I saw a bird, I saw fish," ends more and more, it gets more and more complicated and subtle. This is how the Mahundis teach their children. And Mara, who was taught like this, has found this the most valuable thing in her life. I saw the road I was on disappear into deep water. They could see it down there, black, clean, no weeds, and little fishes wagging their way across it. Boats of all kinds were drawn up on the shore. But the shore of what? This was not a river, for it didn't flow, and you couldn't see the other side, and it was not a lake, but channels between sandy or weedy shoals and water that just covered shallows. A man appeared from a waterside house where boatmen waited and showed them a flat, wide boat with ample room for them and their bundles. Dowlis bargained with him, and Mara parted with 2 more coins. 8 left. They took their places on piles of cushions on a flat bottom through which they could hear the fussing and lapping, and they looked over the boat edges at water they could touch and trail their fingers through. Mara and Dan were thinking, water dragons. The water dragons are crocodiles, which are going to last as long in the future as they have lasted, because they're as old, apparently, as the dinosaurs. The boatman said little fish might nibble their fingers, but that would be the worst. For a while, the boatman seemed to be steering by the road they could still see, and then it descended even deeper. Water had risen up and covered the road and the land around it. When did that happen? The boatman said, a long time ago. He was tried with hundreds of years, thousands. These words meant nothing to him. He said his grandfather had told him there was a family tradition that all this, where water was now, had been frozen down to a depth no one had been able to measure. And then the ice became water. This was slow going, finding their way through marsh, then deep water, then marsh again. Sometimes the bottom was so close to the surface, the boatman used a pole to push the boat along. Flowers floated on long swaying stems. Birds ran over pads of leaves, and from a distance it looked as if they were running on the water. Big white birds sat on islands that were of massed weed, was dipped and swung with ripples from the boat. There were no shores in sight, but at evening they came to rest on a little promontory, and the boatman went off to his shelter, and they to an inn of the serviceable kind, and they ate food designed to satisfy hunger and no more. And they sat about on their pallets talking while the sunset died over the water. They lay down for the night covered with many blankets. And then there was another day of slow travelling. Mara felt her thoughts had slowed, and all her life had become just this. Sitting in a shallow boat just above water that smelled of weed, looking at Dan's face, at letters, at Dallas's, and thinking that she was so much part of them and they of her that she couldn't bear to think that they could ever separate. Days passed. It grew steadily colder, and often cold mist crept about on the water and clung to their faces and hair. They sat wrapped in their grey blankets, even their heads covered. Mara sat dreaming in the water. That is what it felt like, as if she was in the water in a shell. But what a difference from that other journey down south. So hot, the water surface is dazzling and flashing, feeling sick or not, but always the wet heat, the dangers from the water where the dragons watched and waited, and always the reminders along the banks of drought. Mara saw beneath her a roof of red tiles where bunches of weed swayed, and then another roof. The travellers were floating over a drowned town and stretched down their arms to see if they could touch these roofs. The boatman said there'd been many towns round about that had sunk down, big towns. When the ice melted, the earth grew soggy and couldn't hold the weight of the buildings. They sank and the water came up. He jested that if they were fishes, they could swim for many days through drowned cities. And they certainly knew how to live in those days, he said. Look down there. Beneath them, the water was deep, clear, with a white sand bottom. And there was a building grander than anything in the towns they'd travelled through. Steps rose into a great arch of an entrance, which was set among white pillars. And there were stairs up to higher levels, where terraces held figures of carved stone so lifelike it was easy to believe that there were people they'd known or knew now. And the fine roofs of many different coloured tiles, red, blue, green, had windows in them and porches, and it seemed the easiest thing in the world to slide over the edge of the boat and land on a terrace and begin walking about there, live there, with friends. And there will be children, Mara was muttering. There will be big rivers of fast, fresh water and fountains full of water and little streams running into the house, into basins of clear water. Dan was shaking her by the arm. Mara! The boatman had stilled the boat, an oar pushing at a tussock of muddy weed to hold them steady. He was looking carefully at Mara, then bent to feel the pulse in her throat. Then he did the same for Lieta, who was staring at nothing and breathing badly. Then Dallas, whose eyes were shut and grimacing as if in pain. The boatman and Dan whispered together. Mara was aware of a slow rocking through her whole body, yet the boat was still. "The marsh sickness," said the boatman, and tied the boat up to a stump. "Well, they are all very ill, our adventurers, but of course they recover, since this is that kind of story. They have a few more adventures, and since a veggie story has to have a happy ending, it has one. But the tensions between the four, chief four, are pretty great, and I think it's fairly easy to see that perhaps this happy ending might not last. But still, it ends nicely enough. Right, now, that is my adventure story, which I love dearly. I loved writing it. Now, Ben in the World came out this year. It came out earlier here in England. It's doing quite well. And it's come out in America, where it got very good reviews and is selling as well as a book can be expected that isn't of a different kind. So, now, Ben. There's this child which ended with Ben in with a gang of bad youths and with his mother, and the rest of the family had gone. Well, what is happening now is that the family have come back together again, and Ben is out by himself in the world. Everybody exploits poor Ben. Now, when I was wondering how to write this, I thought, where could this poor creature be accepted? Where? Who was going to take him in? It would have to be either criminals who would make use of him, because he's very strong, or anyone who could make use of his strength. Perhaps criminals of a who would use him for something or other. Poor people, almost certainly, who perhaps can't be so fussy about whom they have around. Then I thought we could have an extremely rich and eccentric person who might be fascinated by this. But then I thought that would spoil the tone of the book. So we remain throughout the book on the edge of society. People are also kind to him. Right at the beginning, an old woman, an old poor woman, finding him starving in a supermarket, looks after him and gives him food for a time. She was always trying to find out about Ben. The trouble was, information came out of him in a jumble. But when was that Ben? And it was summer. No, I mean, what year? Well, I don't know, it was after the farm. And when was that? I was there 2 winters. She knew he was about 14 when he left his family. So what had he been doing for 4 years? His mother had been wrong, thinking he'd gone right away. He and his gang of truants from school were camping in an empty house on the edge of their town, and from there made forays, shoplifting, breaking into shops at night, and at weekends went to nearby towns to hang about the streets with the local youths, hoping for a fight and some fun. Ben was their leader because he was so strong and stood up for them. So they thought. But really, the reason was that inwardly he was mature. He was a grown man, more of a parent, whereas they were still children. One by one they were caught, sent to Borstal, or returned to parents and school. One evening he was standing on the edge of a crowd of fighting youngsters. He didn't fight. He was afraid of his strength, his rage. And he realized he was alone and without companions. For a while he was one of a gang of much older youths, but he didn't dominate them as he had the young ones. They forced him to steal for them, made fun of him, jeered at his posh accent. When I finished this book and my agent read it, he said, I appear to have forgotten that he was brought up in a middle-class household and his posh accent would always be a handicap to him. And so I had to rewrite parts of this book and put in the posh accent. He left them and drifted down to the West Country, where he fell in with a motorbike gang which was engaged in warfare with a rival gang. He longed to drive a motorbike, but he couldn't get the hang of it. But it was enough to be near them, these machines. He loved them so. The gang used him to guard their bikes when they went into a cafe or a pub. They gave him food and even a little money sometimes. One night, the rival gang found him standing over half a dozen machines, beat him up, 12-1, and left him bleeding. His own gang returned to find a couple of their machines gone and were ready to beat him up again, but found this apparently slow, stupid oaf transformed into a whirling, screaming madman. He nearly killed one of them. Setting on him altogether, they subdued him, no bones broken, but he was bleeding and sick. He was taken into a pub by a girl who worked there. She washed him down, sat him in a corner, gave him something to eat, and talked him into sense. He was quiet at last. A man came to him, sat down, and asked if he was looking for work. This was how Ben found himself on the farm. He went with Matthew Grinley because he knew that from now on any member of the two gangs seeing him would summon his mates and he would be beaten up again. The farm was well away from any main road down an overgrown and muddy lane. It was neglected, and so was the house, which was large, and bits of it were shut off where the roof leaked too badly. This farm had been left 20 years before by their father to Mary Grinley, Matthew Grinley, and Ted Grinley. A farm, no money. They were pretty well self-sufficient, living off their animals, fruit trees, and vegetable garden. What fields there were, one after another, they had been sold off to neighbouring farmers, grew fodder. Once a month, Mary and Matthew, now Mary and Ben, walked into the village 3 miles off to buy groceries and liquor for Ted. They walked because their car was rusting in a yard. When money was needed for food, electricity, rates, Mary said to Matthew, "Take that beast to market and get what you can for it." This disgraceful place tended to be forgotten by everyone. The locals were part ashamed because of it and part sorry for the Grindleys. It was known that the boys, but they were getting old now, were not far off feeble-minded. They were illiterate, too. Mary had expected to marry, but it had come to nothing. It was she who ran the farm. She told her brothers what to do. Mend that fence, clean out that byre, take the sheep for shearing, plant the vegetables. She was at them all day and bitter because she had to be. Then it was Matthew who was doing all the work. Ted was drinking himself to death in his room. He was no trouble, but he couldn't work. Matthew was getting arthritic and he had chest problems, and soon the hard work was beyond him too. He fed the chickens and looked after the vegetables. Ben was given a room with poor furniture in it, very different from the pleasant rooms he'd been brought up in. He could eat as much as he wanted. He worked from daylight to dark every day. He did know that he did most of the work, but not that without him the farm would collapse. This farm, or anything like it, would soon become impossible when the European Commission issued its diktats and its spy eyes circled forever overhead. The place was a scandal and a waste of good land. People came tramping along the lane and through the farmyard, hoping to buy it. The telephone had been cut off. And they would be met by Mary, an angry old woman, who told them to go away and slammed the door in their face. When, on the neighbouring farms, they were asked about the Grindleys, people tended to equivocate. If they lost the farm, what would happen to those poor derelicts, Ted and Matthew? They'd find themselves in a home, that's what. And Mary? No, let the poor things live out their time. And they had that chap there who'd come from somewhere, no one knew where, a kind of a yeti he looked like, but he did the work well enough. Once, when Ben had gone with Mary to the village to carry groceries back, he was stopped by a man who said to him, "You're with the Grindleys, they say. Are they doing right by you? What do you want? What are they paying you? Not much if I know the Grindleys. I'll make it sure worthwhile to come to me. I'm Tom Wandsworth." Think about it. What did he say? Mary asked, and Ben told her. Ben had never been given a pay book, and terms and conditions had not been mentioned. Mary had given him a couple of quid when they went to the village so he could buy toothpaste, that kind of thing. Now she said, "I'm keeping your wages for you, Ben. You know that." How could he know? This was the first time he'd heard about it. Mary believed he was stupid like her brothers, but now saw trouble loom. "You don't want us to leave. You don't want to leave us, Ben," she said. "You'd not do better with anyone else. I've got a good bit of money put aside for you, and you can have it any time." She pointed to a high-up drawer in her room, then she fetched a chair, made him stand on it, and held it back steady. There were rolls of notes in the drawer. To Ben, it seemed more money than he had imagined possible. "Is that mine?" he asked. "Half of it is yours," said Mary. And when he had gone out of the room, she hid it somewhere else. It was Mary he didn't want to leave, though he was fond of the cow and enjoyed the antics of the pigs. He thought Mary was good to him. She mended his clothes, bought him a new thick jersey for the winter, and gave him plenty of meat to eat. He had a life the others didn't guess at. They all went to bed early with nothing to occupy their minds and no television. Ted was usually drunk and snoring by 9 or 10, and Mary listened to the news on the radio and went to her room afterwards. Ben slid out over the sill of his window when the house was quiet and went about the fields and woods, alone, free, himself. He would catch and eat little animals or a bird. He crouched behind a bush for hours to watch fox cubs play. He sat with his back against a tree trunk and listened to the owls. Or he stood by the cow with his arm around her neck, nuzzling his face into her, and the warmth that came into him from her, and the hot, sweet blast of her breath on his arms and legs when she turned her head to sniff at him, meant the safety of kindness. Or he stood leaning on a fence post staring up at the night sky, and on clear nights he sang a little grunting song to a star. Or he danced around, lifting his feet and stamping. Once old Mary thought she heard a noise that needed investigation, went to a window and caught a glimpse of Ben, crept down in the dark to watch. It really did make her scalp prickle and her flesh go cold. Why should she care what he did for fun? Without him, the animals would be unfed, the cows would stale milk, the pigs would have to live in their dirt. Mary Grindley was curious about Ben, but not much. She'd had too much trouble in her life to care about other people. Then Ted fell down some steps when drunk and died. Surely Matthew should have been next, the half-crippled, coughing man, but it was Mary who had a heart attack. Officials of all kinds suddenly became curious, and one of them, demanding to see accounts, asked Ben questions about himself. Ben was going to say something about the money owed to him, but his instinct shouted at him, "Danger," and he ran away. He picked apples on a cider farm, then he picked raspberries. The other pickers were Poles, mostly students, flown in by a contractor of labour, jolly young people determined to have a good time in spite of the long hours they had to work. Ben was silent, watchful, on his guard. There were caravans to sleep in, but he hated that closeness and the bad air. And when he'd finished eating with them at night, listening to their songs and their jokes and their laughter, he took a sleeping bag into a wood. When the picking was finished, he had a good bit of money, and he was happy, because he knew it was having no money that made him helpless. One of the singing and joking young people stole his money from his jacket that was hanging above him on a bush where he lay asleep. Ben made himself go back to the farm, thinking of all that money in the drawer and half of it belonging to him. But the house was locked, the animals were gone, and there were already nettles growing close up around the house. He didn't care about Matthew, who had scarcely spoken to him, except for unkind remarks such as, "When the old dog died, we don't need another dog, we've got Ben." So he took the old road to London, rich London, where surely there must be a little something for him too. There he did find work, was cheated again, lost heart, and Ellen Briggs found him starving in a supermarket. So he gets taken to Brazil actually by a filmmaker who for a while thinks he's going to make a film about him, changes his mind. So there he is derelict in Rio, being looked after by a poor girl from the favelas and her boyfriend. And I'm afraid it has a very sad ending, because the thing is, there's no place for Ben in this world. I mean, what can one do? Here we are. Let's bump him off.
I'm going to open the questions, but I'll open it first by thanking you very much for the reading. And the question that I have for you is, what are you working on? What are you working on at the moment? What are you working on now?
Well, I've just finished a novel which could be described as being all about money and politics, but it's really an old-fashioned family novel. It covers most of the last century. I wrote two volumes of autobiography, and I can't write the third because people wouldn't like it. They'd be hurt by. So I've written, because what fascinates me is the 60s, which seems to me an extraordinary decade, which everyone's glamorizing. Or, in America, demolishing as if it's all bad. So the center of this book is the 60s, and it'll be coming out next year. It's called The Sweetest Dream, which is not, as you might think, about love, but about all the utopias idiots like me used to believe in once. So, well, you may groan, but we didn't do much good with our utopias, did we?
A lot of people born in the 60s, and your utopias, probably as a result of those utopias, were sitting right next to you.
Well, you are not the result of any utopias.
I might have been a result of one. I also wanted to ask you about happy endings. This has a sad ending. Do you believe in a happy ending? I suppose the question is, you talked about happy endings there. Is your life a happy ending? I know. But if you know her life through and through, it's a life that's gone through many vicissitudes, through many changes, and I admire the spirit with which you've addressed
not just your own work and your own art, but and the politics in which you've lived, but your own life and the tough things you've had to decide for yourself. Are you happy? Are you happy with that?
Happy. I thought it was a silly word. I always did think so. I think it's a kind of process, life. I mean, I'm making mutters with Christmas crackers. It seems to me life is just such hard work all the time. This is my epitaph. Life is just hard work. Nothing wrong with that. But I wouldn't call it a happy ending.
Life is hard work. And Martin Amis, when he was being interviewed here, said that why should he even use the word happy? There was nothing to smile about. Benita, over to you.
Right. Well, the very best reason for our sharing a platform is the pleasure that we both have in interacting with cats, about which you have written with affection and respect and with art sentimentality. At the end of your book, particularly Cats, you write, "Human and cat, we try to transcend what separates us." Now, perhaps this will only have an impact on a very specialized audience, but your writing has attracted so many other audiences. Some know you for your landmark books narrating the changing self-consciousness of women and the redefinitions of gender identities and sexual relationships in the metropolitan world of the mid to the late 20th century. Others remember you with gratitude as a pioneering white critic of mad Southern Africa. Others cherish you as a champion of radical causes from which you have largely disassociated yourself. Yet others may be fans of the very different social critiques that you have written into your utopian or dystopian space fictions. And there could also be those who admire the novels in which you tell of the sorrows and consolations of being an aging woman in our society. When we have questions, we will get to know which of your many audiences are here today. But meanwhile, I should like to ask you which audience you are addressing in your current and your more recent writing, and what dimensions of experience, what ethic are you hoping to make known to your readers?
Well, when I'm writing, I don't think about who is going to be reading what I'm writing, because that makes you self-conscious and you start worrying about are you upsetting people or not. So it's better not to think about that. About the ethic, I don't think about that either. All I'm concerned about is to try and tell the truth in one way or another, and ethics is another department of life altogether.
Well, which truths are you trying? Which dimensions of truth?
What?
In your recent writing, because truths have taken different forms at different times in your writing.
Well,
life,
in The Sweetest Dream, I don't know, you know, I really find it very hard. I've got a terrific generation clash in this, which out of my unconscious emerged a German girl. This is interesting, I'm not German. I did have a German husband once. She is a very well-born girl who marries very comme il faut and properly brought up, which is very strange. It should emerge from my unconscious, let me tell you. But there she is with her little gloves, and she marries a British and English diplomat and becomes English. So she is the grandmother of this clan. Now, very old world and correct, as I say, well brought up, and caring deeply for appearances and how things should be done. And she is now in a house with her daughter-in-law, who is your archetypal 60s hippie, with that attitude towards all the kids that were around then, who were, most of them, screwed up as anything. I'm sure you were. But they were.
No,
and it was people slamming in and out, sleeping on the floor, smoking pot, talking about life and death day and night while she cooked for them. And poor old Julia upstairs listens to this in deep sorrow, partly because she is appalled every minute, and partly because she can't join in, because she's incapable of doing something like, I say, come in and sit down and learn a extra place. I mean, it's not her world. So this is a fairly basic culture clash. But where ethics come in, I don't know. I'm just concerned about trying to convey something of the flavour of that quite extraordinary decay. And what a contradictory one.
There is, quite obviously, there is a gap in what you write, how you write. And there's a gap between that and those of us who approach writing as critics, and I'm sure it must be extremely annoying, irritating to writers to have to listen to critical comments, and I'm aware of this. So that if I go on to say that despite the diversity of your writing and the shifts that have taken place within it, there seems to me a continuity in your novels, and I see this consistency in the particular accents of a narrative voice, in style, in diction, and in narrative structure. Now, while observing this, someone reading from the outside as a critic will also notice significant transitions in what the novels are attempting to communicate. Now, one of these you write about in your autobiography, when you speak about the pressing in of a world you had excluded as impossible, and which led you to a systematic search for something different. This is in volume 2 of your autobiography. Now, you have written about this journey reticently but sufficiently in your autobiography, and I hope you won't find it intrusive if I ask of you to tell this audience something about how you perceive Sufism, because there's a tremendous ignorance about what Sufi is, about its absorption into Islam, as indeed there is about Islam. So if you can just very briefly communicate the significance of Sufism.
Well, I can't do it very briefly. I'm very sorry. In the first place, Sufism predates Islam.
Yeah.
And it was a part of it for a while. I can't talk about Islam, and I don't think there's any need to, because anyone can get a book about Islam and read up about it. The books are all there. It's very easy. Apart from the fact most of us have Muslim neighbours, one can get to know them. I don't think it's necessary for me to talk about Islam. But Sufism is something I've been studying for 30 years with surprises all the way. So anybody, I couldn't possibly talk about that. Can I just say that it is not a guru system, which people always assume, because as soon as you hear about this kind of thing, you think, oh, guru, no gurus. It's not a cult. There are certain, rules for cults, which any sociologist will tell you. So it's not a cult. It is something that you become immersed in. If anybody is interested, and I do understand really that a lot of people here probably weren't interested at all, anybody's interested in what I've been studying, there are books by a man called Idris Shah, which are in print. And there are quite a few of them by now. They were part of what you might call a curriculum, if you like. Any of us who studied the Shah studied the books, and which were very varied on many different kinds, from the joke corpus of Nasruddin, some people might know about, and to quite high-level metaphysics. So it's the Octagon Press publisher has his books in print. The Octagon Press, any bookseller can order for you a catalogue. I would suggest, if you're interested in overall view, there's a book called, quite simply, The Sufis by Idris Shah, which might interest you or might not. When I read it, in the very early 60s, I thought, my God, this is what I've been waiting for all my life. But I knew people who read it and said, what a load of old socks. So, there we are. We're in the bookshops.
One of the reasons that prompted my question is that although one can read about Sufi and one can read about Islam, there is in fact in the commonly a great deal of really quite grotesque and gross ignorance about Islam. And those who will go and read books will in fact find in the books that Sufi is subsumed as something that's been absorbed into Islam and forms a significant part of the devotional practice in various Islamic societies. And it just seemed to me significant that Islam is not a monolith, although it is presumed to be, and that it accommodates so many different strands, that it was really as a sort of, you know, a block against, an attempt to break down this block of ignorance. Anyway, I'll move on.
Benita, could I just pass maybe for two questions from the audience then, and then pass back to yourself?
Or I can cut what I have to say short by just asking one more question.
Yes,
should we do that?
Yes, that'd be great.
Because I think some of my questions might well come from the audience. If they don't, then I'll come back to them. When the organisers of the writing programme asked me to introduce you to the audience, it occurred to me that they might have done so because we are both post-mature women who grew up in southern Africa and who were dissidents in the grotesque old regimes of injustice and inequality in South Africa. All the same, I find our experiences within the left movements in southern Africa are so different that I want to ask if the reason that I give is a sufficient one. And that is that in southern Africa, the left was the one place where one could escape the terrible provincialism of white South Africa. And in South Africa, other than in the then Rhodesia, there was a significant number of black intellectuals who were both in touch with their communities, not detached and dissociated from them, and also in touch with white intellectuals, so that it made for a culture of, within the left movement, of debate, of discussion, of openness to other ideas, and of internationalism that one would not have come across elsewhere. And
left was largely self-invented. We created a communist party, which no proper communist party would acknowledge as one, because they're all so idealistic. It was indeed the one place where you could escape from provincialism, because there were all the people from RAF from England, many of them from that working class culture of night schools, schools, etc., which has completely vanished from Britain, unfortunately, and a great many refugees, every one of which was an intellectual. So I escaped from Rhodesian provincialism. These are the first people I've ever met who read everything I'd read. Before that, I just kept quiet. I read and kept quiet. Suddenly I was with people who took it for granted that one should read. They were also the only people I ever met who took it for granted that this monstrous society could not possibly last. There was no way one could even breathe that thought anywhere outside the circle. So yes, it was, for me, it was a great liberation.
Do you want to open it now?
Yes,
because I can come back if the questions are not asked from the floor.
I'd like now to open this to the audience. If you have a question, could you put your hand up and flap it around quite hard so that I can see you all? You were first.
I'm thinking tonight for writing the next time you're
on melody,
or you
No, I can't write volume three because in the 60s, I was that very familiar 60s figure, a kind of house mother. And my house was full of adolescents of various kinds, all of whom were in diabolical trouble, which is why I don't really regard the 60s as much charity. And they're all now grown up, middle-aged, and some of them are famous. And the last thing I would want to do is to embarrass them with horrible tales about their horrible adolescence. So that is why I can't write Volume 3.
Very good. Yep.
I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the 1960s, because you said it was an extraordinary decade. And today, lots of people trivialise it. There's been a massive reaction against a lot of what it was about. Others glamorise it. I'd like to ask you what you think was extraordinary about it, what was particular and extraordinary. And secondly, what was the lasting significance about it?
Well, it seems to me the two most significant things about it. The first one was that for the first time ever in history, the young ones were a market. They were being wooed by people who wanted to sell them things. They didn't see themselves in this light. They saw themselves as some marvelous free spirit. In actual fact, they were people who were being infinitely manipulated by advertising of every kind. And experience obviously was wonderful, you know, because their clothes were lovely. I lived in a house full of these gorgeous girls who bought a new dress every week and threw it away the week after. The other most, much more important than that, was that this is when drugs hit the West. Before that, I think a few selected souls took laudanum, sort of like Coleridge and that lot. Oh, but suddenly drugs were everywhere. And this had never happened to our society before. At the time, some people seemed to find it quite exciting. Others, some of whom I knew had lived in cultures where drugs were endemic, said that we would quite soon understand that only the losers in a society were drug takers. At that time, it was extremely hard to see this fact. We now know, of course, that, I mean, I don't really want to get onto a soapbox about this debated pot, but we now know that pot, in fact, destroys the communicating cells in the brain. If you take enough pot, you make yourself stupid. Nobody wants to believe this because pot is such an attractive drug. What is the least important thing about it was the... Wait, I want to put another third good thing about it, which was that large numbers of people, for the first time from the working class and the lower middle class, escaped through the grammar schools, which are now being abolished, away from what they were in, into... Half my friends come from grammar schools. They are now being abolished, with nothing being put in their place. This is a terrible thing. Now, the least important thing about the decade was the frost, seems to me. While it was very enjoyable, I have no doubt, I was too old for the 60s, which might account for my sour tone. I was too old to enjoy it. It was amusing. I don't want to be unnecessary. I thought it was trivial. The really important things had nothing to do with the noise and the Beatles were a good thing. I'll give another good thing. The Beatles were a good thing. Okay, would you agree with any of that?
Yes, you don't mention sexual liberation.
Well, I forgot about sexual liberation. I don't agree that that was sexual. You see, what is this myth that sex was invented in 1964? I mean, in the 50s, everyone was having a whale of a time. Why do they go on about the 60s? But I have to say that some of my young friends say that they came to London and suddenly discovered paradise. So, okay. I just don't agree that it was... You know, the real liberation came after the First World War. That did in for the old morality. And the 20s and 30s were, as we all know from novels, liberated. The war, not World War II, was certainly liberated because... you were reaping roses before you died. I've forgotten the quotation now. Anything went in the war. Suddenly we're asked to believe that 50s were some kind of prison house. Well, I just don't believe it.
The second volume of your autobiography, I think you're writing a letter to somebody called Edward. The minute she said the novel was dying, do you really think that?
No, I must have been in a very bad mood. That was that was Edward Thompson, the Marxist historian, and we were engaged in a terrific altercation. We were always in an altercation. So I don't know why I said the novel was dying, because it manifestly isn't.
When I read the Golden Notebook, it really made me want to write, but that didn't last very long. The process of writing a novel is so daunting for somebody who is not obsessive about it. Has it always been the fact that you were always going to write, or was it ever a daunting prospect, especially when your main character is someone completely better than you, like a young boy, Dennis, for example? I mean, you said before that the child was asked, what have you seen today? And that struck a chord with me. I thought maybe what you were doing there was trying to get a pure response by actually observing the world. Am I wrong there? Or is there something in that? And have you understood my question?
Well, you see, it's not one question, it's many questions, isn't it? It seems to me that for everybody, the question of the chief difficulty about writing is getting the time and the energy to do it. That is the first thing. It's not ideas or plots or any of these things. It is getting the time, and it seems to me that more and more it's difficult to find. You know, writing isn't just a question of sitting in front of the typewriter, me. I haven't got to the word pressure yet, at all yet. It's a question of getting a clear space where there aren't any pressures, and you are rather bored, which suits most writers, rather bored, and you have time to simply sit around and think. That's the difficulty.
I think there's a bit more to it than that.
No, because the reason why most people who want to write don't is because they use up their energies in every other way. I mean, they'll do anything. They'll go out every night and dance, or then wonder why they can't write next morning. I mean, what about these busy women with small children who want to write? For them, it is an absolute agony to find time to write. Or the men who have to go to the office for however many hours they have to a day, you know. Nobody has... There's a certain kind of energy you need. This is the kind of energy you have to find for yourself. And it's the most important thing.
I think that's probably what you said then. It's the most important thing in your life, and therefore you sacrifice everything else to do that. And that single-mindedness has to be something that you have a purpose. Your life is the purpose of your life.
Exactly, you have to sacrifice things to write, otherwise you don't write, or you write out of the top of your head, or
yes, you're talking, no life. You're talking about having a discipline.
Yes.
It's the discipline that you need. I don't want to interject here. I have brought up a child as a baby myself on my own. I run this writing program here. I write books, but in order to do so, the discipline that's required means. Basically no social life.
You also need talent, though.
Energy. There's a question here.
Which writer's past was particularly admiring? Would you say that anyone has had an influence on your own work?
Well, it seems to me that if you read a lot, which I've been doing since I was about 7, it's not a question of one writer. You get a kind of, I call it a compost. You know, you've read all these books, and they sort of feed you in ways that you're often not conscious of. Not at all a question of copying them, but another thing is they give you a useful eye on your own work, so you can see very often where it's bad. If you haven't read any decent literature, then you don't know when something's good or bad. You have nothing to compare it with.
Thank you.
So to be a great writer, you have to be a great reader.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Sorry. So, yeah?
Yes, I'm interested in the links or the tensions, whichever way you see, between communist ideas and student thought, and to use a sort of metaphor, as it were. Do you feel that it's impossible?
Links between what ideas?
Between communist ideas and Sufi thought.
I don't see any links.
Well, that's what I'm interested in to check. But to use the Sufi metaphor, do you believe it is possible for all of the people to be awake?
All of the people to be?
All of the people
awake.
To be awake.
No, I don't. What do you mean by that? By awake?
Sorry?
What do you mean by all the people being awake?
I'm thinking of the Sufi metaphor you mentioned in books by Ibn Shah, where there's quite often reference to people being asleep for large portions of their lives, but having the potential to become awake. I guess one of the things that suggests is that at any given time there's only a small number of people who are awake, to use a sense, which could be interpreted as an elitist model, as opposed to the ideology that you were very much involved in earlier on, the communist beliefs.
Well, may I point out that there's never been a more elitist model of thought than the communists that believed in the dictatorship of the proletariat, which was going to be led by the Communist Party, an elite by definition. I don't know why it took me so many years not seeing this obvious fact. This is one of the most elitist doctrines that have ever been evolved. About this awake, there are degrees of being awake. It's not just sleep or semi-trance or being fully awake, but there are lots of degrees in between. It's very interesting if you happen to be in a fairly alert state yourself, let's say on the London Underground, looking around. Half the people are in a state of trance, mild trance. I mean, real trance, they're not there, out of boredom or exhaustion or something. And then you'll see them, they suddenly snap back into themselves. But you can see this going on all the time. And of course, you do it yourself. You suddenly come to out of something that's not far off a trance.
Mm-hmm. I see it going on every week. I do one of these.
Yep.
Yes, I'm really struck by the way in which you talk about 1960s. The Golden Notes and so many of your novels celebrate that period in a way that's still really very moving. Do you think that some of your recent work is a kind of mourning of a lost utopia? It's the figure of a child who's taken in, where things go wrong. It's a theme in some of your more recent novels. And you describe yourself in the 60s really interestingly as a kind of hippie housemother taking in these adolescents and so on. I'd really be interested to know.
You know, the Golden Notebook was published, as far as I can remember, in 1962, I think it was. So it couldn't have been about the 60s. It wasn't about the 60s at all. It couldn't have been.
But it's about those kinds of utopias. One of the things
that makes it such an exciting book, really, is
that
it's pre-visioning,
a number of
the
things that happened in the 1960s.
That's what's
one of the things
that's
exciting.
Well, okay. I don't think that... I can't see the connection often between things that people who ask me questions can see. I don't see the connection between my poor Ben, for example, and the kids I took in the 60s. Ben is a story of greatest possible realism on a totally impossible basis. It's got an impossible base. It's not possible for a creature... a genetic throwback for many, many thousands, if not millions of years, to suddenly arrive in an English family. It's impossible. It's a fairy story. It's a legend. So it interested me for completely different reasons than But that's okay, you know. I don't want to issue a book into the world saying, you have to read it like this, you know, because none of my books astound me sometimes by the kind of reception they get, which I never expected. Who would have believed that, that's just too difficult, let's leave that.
Who would have believed what? What was that?
Well, I was thinking about books that have had a reception that I was absolutely astounded by. One was a gold notebook, but let's go into that. The Fifth Child, which is not the happiest book that was ever written, is liked by young people. When I go to schools, the teachers nearly always tell me that their kids adore The Fifth Child. This astounded me for a long time. Then I thought, okay, well, adolescence, I mean, we all remember that, we old ones, we were graceless, awkward, we knew we would never be able to cope with a grown-up world, we were always saying the wrong thing, and here you have Ben, an archetypal misfit, if there ever was one, so that's why they like him. But I have to say that I was in a school in North London, which was interesting for more than one reason. It was a school, I walked into a room with about 20 people in it, and they were all Asiatics except for two white people. And this was the top literary kids. So here was this girl, as beautiful as a plum fairy, who says to me, but I am Ben. I say, you are not. A misshapen misfit from the remote past. I am Ben. So, okay. I mean, I don't argue. All right.
Yeah.
Is there, speaking of arguing, is there a character or a voice which you've created through, because there seem to be quite a number of different protagonists and very differently created protagonists, is there one with whom you would now, looking back, have an argument? Would time have created a rift between you and that character?
Well, I think if I met Martha Quest, aged, let's say, 16, we might have an interesting conversation.
About?
Well, she was certainly a very antagonistic and difficult girl. So, while I understand exactly... Sorry. I read to them Martha Quest the other day, and I thought, my God, you poor girl. I don't know who would. You see, the thing is, when you're writing books all the time, it's a kind of a process that goes on. You don't. You think, okay, that's what how I was then. I couldn't possibly write The Golden Notebook now, for example, because the atmosphere has changed so absolutely that you couldn't possibly write it. I couldn't write The Grass Is Singing now.
What do you think you're going to write next? I see what you were writing now. What do you think is next?
I don't know. It's wonderful. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting. Like, I don't know, I'm going to say something fairly irreverent for the annunciation.
Let me know when it comes. Any other questions? Yes?
I just wanted to... I'm thinking of your fiction, and I'm also thinking of Margaret Atwood. And although the two is very, very different, with both there seems to be an increasing movement into myth, or a kind of interplay between myth and realism. But what you notice of the movement into myth in your work, into the space fiction that you've done, and in Atwood, in her new book, The Blind Assassin, the interplay with a mythical world, a mythical country, and yet the realism as well. And I wondered if you thought that was a usual movement for writers.
Well, my last book, this just started off on its journey through the machinery, is absolute realism.
That's realism.
It hasn't got any myth anywhere in it. Not even a dream, I don't think.
There was one of them.
Two.
Okay.
1992, from reading another, and I was just wondering what do you think about contemporary literature and how people like Danilo Narita trying to compare to yours in terms of their power and prejudice. So I was wondering.
What do I think about literature in Zimbabwe?
Yeah.
Well, I've said many times publicly and in writing how much I admire the writers of Zimbabwe. And it's an astonishing thing that this little country, which, you know, it's a little country with not an enormous population, has produced so many fine writers. Could you talk more loudly?
If you must. Your writings have been compared to writing by Ao.
Writing have been compared to what?
Dembuzo Marachera, who's speaking about specifically.
Well, I don't think there's really very much in common between us. You know, he was a very... he had the most terrible life. Did you know him? Did you know him?
Yeah.
Well, he... I mean, compared to him, I've had a life of peaches and cream. He had a terrible life, and he made something wonderful in his work out of it. But I don't think I've ever been under such awful pressure as he was. He was also an alcoholic, you know. He was quite crazy at the end. He was very ill. He was too ill to be saved. He was a tragic figure. This Marachera.
There's another question from up there. Could you please? Could you put your hand up again? No, across here.
Oh, good. Good.
Well, if that's the end of the questions, I would like to bring the session to a close by thanking you very much for coming tonight. But before you go, the bookshop is open just outside there. For those of you who still have your tickets, redeem them against the price of the books and bring them back down here. And thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Sarah.